Bring up the bodies. Disc 12.
The Queen wears scarlet and black, and instead of a hood, a jaunty cap, with feathers of black and white sweeping across its brim. Remember those plumes, he tells himself. This will be the last time. Or almost so. How did she look? The women will ask. He will be able to say she looked pale but unafraid. How can it be for her to enter that great chamber and to stand before the peers of England, all men, and none of them desiring her? She is tainted now. She is dead meat. And instead of coveting her, bosom, hair, eyes, their gaze slides away. Only Uncle Norfolk glares at her fiercely, as if her head were not Medusa's head. In the centre of the great hall at the tower they have built a platform with benches for the judges and peers, and there are some benches too in the side arcades, but the most part of the spectators will be standing, pushing in behind each other till the guards say, "No more," and block the doorways with staves. Even then they push, and the noise rises as those who have been let through jostle in the well of the court, till Norfolk, his white baton of office in his hand, calls for silence, and from the ferocious expression on his face the most ignorant person in that throng knows he means it. Here is the Lord Chancellor, seated by the Duke, to supply him with the best legal advice in the kingdom. Here is the Earl of Worcester, whose wife, you might say, started all this, and the Earl gives him a filthy look. He does not know why. Here is Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, who has hated Anne since he set eyes on her, and has made it plain to the king's face. Here is the Earl of Arundel, the Earl of Oxford, the Earl of Rutland, the Earl of Westmoreland. Among them he moves softly, plain Thomas Cromwell, a greeting here, and a word there, spreading reassurance. The Crown's case is in order, no upsets are expected or will be tolerated. We shall all be home for supper and sleep safely in our own beds tonight. Lord Sands, Lord Audley, Lord Clinton, and many lords more, each pricked off on a list as they take their seats. Lord Morley, George Boleyn's father-in-law, who reaches for his hand and says, "Please, Thomas Cromwell, as you love me, let not this sordid business rebound on my poor little daughter Jane." She was not so much your poor little daughter, he thinks, when you married her off without asking her. But it is common. You cannot blame him as a father, for as the king once said to him ruefully, it is only very poor men and women who are free to choose who they love. He clasps Lord Morley's hand in return, and wishes him courage, and bids him take his seat, for the prisoner is among us and the court prepared. He bows to the foreign ambassadors. But where is Chapuis? Word is passed forward. He is suffering from a quartan fever. Word is passed back. I am sorry to hear that. Let him send to my house for anything that might make him more comfortable. Say his fever is up today, day one. Its tide ebbing tomorrow, by Wednesday he is on his feet, but shaky, but by Thursday night he will be down again as it shakes him in its grip. The Attorney General reads the indictment, and it takes some time, crimes under statute, crimes under God. As he gets to his feet to prosecute, he is thinking, the king expects a verdict by mid-afternoon, and glancing across the court he sees Francis Bryan, still in his outdoor coat, ready to get on the river with word to the Seymours. Steady, Francis, he thinks. This may take some time. It may get hot in here. The substance of the case is the work of an hour or two, but when there are 95 names to be verified of the justices and the peers, then the mere shuffling and the throat-clearing, the nose-blowing, the adjustment of robes and the settling of belt-sashes, all those distracting rituals that some men need before they speak in public, with all that it is clear the day will wear on. The Queen herself is a still presence, listening intently from her chair as the list of her crimes is read out, the dizzying catalogue of times, dates, places, of men, their members, their tongues, into the mouth, out of the mouth, into diverse crannies of the body, at Hampton Court, in Richmond Palace, at Greenwich and Westminster, in Middlesex and in Kent, and then the loose words and taunts, the jealous quarrels and twisted intentions, the declaration by the Queen that when her husband is dead she will choose some one of them to be her husband, but she cannot yet say which. Did you say that? She shakes her head. You must answer aloud. Icy little voice.
No.
It is all she will say. No, no, and no. And once she answers yes, when she is asked if she has given money to Weston, and she hesitates and admits it. And there is a whoop from the crowd, and Norfolk stops proceedings and threatens he will have them all arrested if they do not keep silence. In any well-ordered country, Suffolk said yesterday, the trial of a noblewoman would be conducted in seemly privacy. He had rolled his eyes and said, But my lord, this is England. Norfolk has obtained quiet, a rustling calm punctuated by coughs and whispers. He is ready for the prosecution to resume. He says, Very well, go on, you. Not for the first time, he is baffled by having to speak to a common man, who is not an ostler or a carter, but a minister of the king. The Lord Chancellor leans forward and whispers, reminding him perhaps that the prosecutor is master of the rolls. Carry on, your mastership, he says more politely. Please do proceed. She denies treason. There is the point. She never raises her voice, but she disdains to enlarge, to excuse, extenuate, to mitigate. And there is no one to do it for her. He remembers what Wyatt's old father had once told him, how a dying lioness can maul you, flash out with her claw and scar you for life. But he feels no threat, no tension, nothing at all. He is a good speaker, known for eloquence, style, and audibility, but today he has no interest in whether he is heard, not beyond the judges, the accused, as whatever the populace hear they will misconstrue. And so his voice seems to fade to a drowsy murmur in the room, the voice of a country priest droning through his prayers, no louder than a fly buzzing in a corner, knocking against glass. Out of the corner of his eye he sees the Attorney General stifle a yawn, and he thinks, I have done what I thought I could never achieve. I have taken adultery, incest, conspiracy, and treason, and I have made them routine. We do not need any false excitement. After all, it is a law court, not the Roman circus. The verdicts drag in. It is a lengthy business. The court implores brevity. No speeches, please. One word will suffice. 95 vote guilty, and not one naysayer. When Norfolk begins to read the sentence, the roar rises again, and one can feel the pressure of the people outside trying to get in, so it seems the hall gently rocks, like a boat at its mooring.
Her own uncle,
someone wails, and the Duke bangs his fist on the table and says he will do slaughter. That produces some quiet. The hush allows him to conclude.
Thy judgment is this. Thou shalt be burned here within the tower, or else have thy head smitten off, as the king's pleasure shall be further known.
There is a yelp from one of the justices. The man is leaning forward, whispering furiously. Norfolk looks irate. The lawyers are going into a huddle. The peers crane forward to find out what is the delay. He strolls over. Norfolk says,
These fellows tell me I have not done it right. I cannot say burning or beheading. I have to say one. And they say it must be burning. That is how a woman suffers when she is a traitor.
My Lord Norfolk has his instructions from the king. He means to crush objection, and he does. The phrasing is the king's pleasure. And moreover, do not tell me what can be done and what cannot. We have never tried a queen before.
We're just making it up as we go,
says the Lord Chancellor amiably.
Finish what you were saying,
he tells Norfolk. He steps back.
I think I have done,
Norfolk says, scratching his nose.
Head smitten off, as the king's pleasure shall be further known of the same.
The Duke drops his voice and concludes at conversational pitch, so the queen never hears the end of her sentence. She has the gist, though. He watches her rise from her chair, still composed, and he thinks, She doesn't believe it. Why doesn't she believe it? He looks across to where Francis Bryan was hovering, but the messenger has already gone. Rochford's trial has now to go forward. They must get Anne out before her brother comes in. The solemnity of the occasion has dissipated. The more elderly members of the court have to totter out to piss, and the younger to stretch their legs and have a gossip and collect the latest odds on an acquittal for George. The betting runs in his favour, though his face, as he is brought in, shows he is not deceived. To those who insist he will be acquitted, he, Cromwell, has said, "If Lord Rochford can satisfy the court, he will be let go. Let us see what defence he will make." He has only one real fear, that Rochford is not vulnerable to the same pressure as the other men, because he is not leaving behind anyone he cares for. His wife has betrayed him, his father deserted him, and his uncle will preside over the court that tries him. He thinks George will speak with eloquence and spirit, and he is correct. When the charges are read to him, he asks that they be put one by one, clause by clause. "For what is your worldly time, gentlemen, against God's assurance of eternity?" There are smiles, admiration for his suavity. Boleyn addresses him, Cromwell, directly. "Put them to me one by one, the times, the places. I will confound you." But the contest is not even. He has his papers, and if it comes to it, he can lay them on the table and make his case without them. He has his trained memory. He has his accustomed self-possession, his courtroom voice that places no strain on his throat, his urbanity of manner that places no strain on his emotions. And if George thinks he will falter, reading out the details of caresses administered and received, then George does not know the place he comes from, the times, the manners that have formed Master Secretary. Soon enough, Lord Rochford will begin to sound like a raw, tearful boy. He is fighting for his life, and thus unequal to a man who seems so indifferent to the outcome. Let the court acquit if it will, there will be another court, or a process more informal that will end with George a broken corpse. He thinks, too, that soon young Boleyn will lose his temper, that he will show his contempt for Henry, and then it will all be up with him. He hands Rochford a paper. "Certain words are written here which the Queen is said to have spoken to you, and you in your turn passed them on. You need not read them aloud. Just tell the court, do you recognize those words?" George smiles in disdain. Relishing the moment, he smirks. He takes a breath. He reads the words aloud. "The king cannot copulate with a woman. He has neither skill nor vigour." He has read it because he thinks the crowd will like it. And so they do, though the laughter is shocked, incredulous. But from his judges, and it is they who matter, there is an audible hiss of deprecation. George looks up. He throws out his hands. "These are not my words. I do not own them." But he owns them now. In one moment of bravado, to get the applause of the crowd, he has impugned the succession, derogated the king's heirs, even though he was cautioned not to do it. He, Cromwell, nods. "We have heard that you spread rumours that the Princess Elizabeth is not the king's child. It seems you do. You have spread them even in this court." George is silent. He shrugs and turns away. It is hard on George that he cannot even mention the charges against him without becoming guilty of them. As a prosecutor, he would rather it had gone unmentioned, the king's difficulty, yet it is no more of a shame to Henry to have it declared in court than have it said in the street, and in taverns where they are singing the ballad of King Little Prick and his wife the witch. In such circumstances, the man blames the woman as often as not. Something she has done, something she has said, the black look she gave him when he faltered, the derisive expression on her face. Henry is afraid of Anne, he thinks, but he will be potent with his new wife. He gathers himself, gathers his papers. The judges wish to confer. The case against George is flimsy enough in all truth, but if the charges are thrown out, Henry will arraign him on some other matter, and it will go hard with his family, not just the Boleyns, but the Howards too. For this reason, he thinks Uncle Norfolk will not let him escape. And no one has denounced the charges as incredible, at this trial or the trials that preceded it. It has become a thing one can believe, that these men would plot against the king and copulate with the queen. Weston because he is reckless, Breton because he is old in sin, Mark because he is ambitious, Henry Norris because he is familiar, he is close, he has confused his own person with the person of the king, and George Boleyn, not despite being her brother, but because he is her brother. Boleyns, it is known to all, will do what they need to do to rule. If Anne Boleyn put herself on the throne, walking on the bodies of the fallen, can she not put a Boleyn bastard there too? He looks up at Norfolk, who gives him a nod. The verdict is in no doubt, then, nor the sentence. The only surprise is Harry Percy. The Earl rises from his place. He stands, his mouth open slightly, and a silence falls. Not the rustling, whispering apology for a silence which the court has endured till now, but a still, expectant hush. He thinks of Gregory. Do you want to hear me make a speech? Then the Earl pitches forward, unleashes a groan. He crumples, and with a clatter and a thud he hits the floor. At once his prone body is swamped by guardsmen, and a great roar arises. Harry Percy is dead! Unlikely, he thinks. They'll bring him round. It is now mid-afternoon, warm and airless, and the evidence placed before the judges, the written statements alone, would fell a healthy man. There is a length of blue cloth laid over the new boards of the platform on which the judges sit, and he watches the guardsmen rip it up from the floor and improvise a blanket in which to carry the Earl, and a memory stabs him. Italy, heat, blood, heaving and rolling and flopping a dying man onto knotted saddle cloths, cloths themselves scavenged from the dead, hauling him into the shade of the wall of, what, a church, a farmhouse? Only so that he could die cursing a few minutes later, trying to pack his guts back into the wound from which they were spilling, as if he wanted to leave the world tidy. He feels sick, and he sits down by the Attorney General. The guardsmen carry the Earl out, head lolling, eyes closed, feet dangling. His neighbour says,
"There is another man the Queen has ruined. I suppose we will not know them all for years."
It is true. The trial is a provisional arrangement, a fix for getting Anne out, Jane in. The effects of it have not been tested yet. The resonances have not been felt. But he expects a quaking at the heart of the body politic, a heaving in the stomach of the Commonwealth. He gets up and goes over to urge Norfolk to get the trial underway. George Boleyn, suspended as he is between trial and conviction, looks as though he might collapse himself and has begun to weep. "Help Lord Rochford to a chair," he says. "Give him something to drink." He is a traitor, but still an earl. He can hear his death sentence sitting down. Next day, the 16th of May, he is at the Tower, with Kingston in the constable's own lodgings. Kingston is fretting because he does not know what sort of scaffold to prepare for the Queen. She lies under a dubious sentence, waiting for the King to speak. Cranmer is with her in her lodgings, come to hear her confession, and he will be able to hint to her delicately that her cooperation now will spare her pain, that the King still has mercy in him. A guardsman at the door addressing the constable.
"There is a visitor. Not for yourself, sir. For Master Cromwell. It is a foreign gentleman."
It was Jean de Danteville, who was here on embassy round about the time Anne was crowned. Jean stands poised in the doorway.
"They said I should find you here, and as time is short..."
"My dear friend," they embrace, "I did not even know you were in London."
"I am straight off the boat."
"Yes, you look it."
"I am no sailor."
The ambassador shrugs, or at least his vast padding moves and subsides again. On this balmy morning, he is wrapped up in bewildering layers, much as a man dresses to face November.
"Anyway, it seemed best to come here and catch you before you are back playing bowls, which I believe you generally do when you should be receiving our representatives. I am sent to speak to you about young Weston."
Good God, he thinks. Has Sir Richard Weston managed to bribe the King of France? Not a moment too soon. He is sentenced to die tomorrow. What about him?
"One is uneasy," the ambassador says, "if gallantry should be punished. Surely the young man is guilty of nothing more than a poem or two, paying compliments and making jests. Perhaps the King might spare his life. One understands that for a year or two he would be advised to keep away from the court. Travelling, perhaps?"
"He has a wife and young son, monsieur. Not that the thought of them has ever constrained his behaviour."
"So much the worse if the King puts him to death. Does Henry not regard his reputation as a merciful prince?"
"Oh, yes. He talks about it a lot. Monsieur, my advice is to forget Weston. much as my master reveres and respects yours. He will not take it kindly if King Francis were to interfere in something which is, after all, a family matter, something he feels very near his own person. Danteville is amused.
One might well call it a family matter.
I notice you do not ask mercy for Lord Rochford. He has been an ambassador. One thought the King of France would be more interested in him.
Ah, well, the ambassador says, George Boleyn. One understands there is a change of regime and what that entails. The whole French court hopes, of course, that Monseigneur will not be destroyed.
Wiltshire? He has been a good servant to the French. I see you would miss him. He is in no danger at present. Of course, you cannot look for his influence to be what it was. A change of regime, as you say.
May I say...
The ambassador stops to sip wine, to nibble a wafer that Kingston's servants have provided.
That we in France find this whole business incomprehensible. Surely if Henry wishes to be rid of his concubine, he can do it quietly.
The French do not understand law courts or parliaments. For them, the best actions are covert actions.
And if he must parade his shame to the world, surely one or two adulteries are enough.
However, Cromwell, the ambassador runs his eye over him,
we can speak man to man, can we not? The great question is, can Henry do it? Because what we hear is, he prepares himself, and then his lady gives him a certain look, and his hopes collapse. That seems to us like witchcraft, as witches do commonly render men impotent. But,
he adds with a look of sceptical contempt,
I cannot imagine that any Frenchman would be so afflicted.
You must understand, he says, though Henry is at all points a man, he is a gentleman, and not a cur grunting in the gutter with, well, I say nothing of your own king's choice of women. These last months, he takes a breath, these last weeks particularly, have been a time of great trial and grief for my master. He now seeks happiness. Have no doubt that his new marriage will secure his realm and promote the welfare of England. He is talking as if he is writing. Already he is casting his version into dispatches.
Oh, yes, the ambassador says, the little person. One hears no great praise either of her beauty or her wit. He will not really marry her, another woman of no importance. When the emperor offers him such lucrative matches, or so we hear. We understand everything, Cromwell. As a man and a woman, the king and the concubine may have their disputes, but there are more than the two of them in the world. This is not the Garden of Eden. When all's said, it is the new politics she doesn't suit. The old queen was, in some sort, the concubine's protector, and ever since she died, Henry has been plotting how he may become a respectable man again. So he must wed the first honest woman he sees. And in all truth, it really does not matter whether she is the emperor's relative or no, because with the Boleyns gone, Cromwell is riding high, and he will be sure to pack the council with good imperialists.
His lip curls. It might be a smile.
Cromwell, I wish you would say how much the Emperor Charles pays you. I have no doubt we could match it.
He laughs. Your master is seated on thorns. He knows my king has money flowing in. He is afraid that he might pay France a visit, and in arms.
You know what you owe King Francis.
The ambassador is annoyed.
Only our negotiations, most astute and subtle negotiations, prevent the Pope from striking your country from the list of Christian nations. We have, I think, been loyal friends to you, representing your cause better than you can yourselves.
He nods. I always enjoy hearing the French praise themselves. Will you dine with me later this week, once this is over, and your queasiness has settled down? The ambassador inclines his head. His cap badge glitters and winks. It is a silver skull.
I shall report to my master that, sadly, I have tried and failed in the matter of Weston.
So you came too late. The tide was against you.
No. I shall say Cromwell was against me. By the way, you know what Henry has done, don't you?
He seems amused.
He sent last week for a French executioner. Not from one of our own cities, but the man who chops heads in Calais. It seems there is no Englishman whom he trusts to behead his wife. I wonder he does not take her out himself and strangle her in the street.
He turns to Kingston. The constable is an elderly man now, and though he was in France on the king's business 15 years ago, he has not had much use for the language since. The cardinal's advice was, speak English and shout loud.
Did you get that? He asks.
Henry has sent to Calais for the headsman.
By the mass, Kingston says. Did he do it before the trial?
So Monsieur the Ambassador tells me.
I am glad of the news, Kingston says, loudly and slowly. My mind much relieved.
He taps his head.
I understand he employs a...
He makes a swishing motion.
Yes, a sword, Danteville says in English. You may expect a graceful performance.
He touches his hat.
Au revoir, Master Secretary.
They watch him go out. It is a performance in itself. His servants need to trust him in further wrappings. When he was here on his last mission, he spent the time sweltering under quilts, trying to sweat out a fever picked up from the influence of the English air, the moisture and the gnawing cold.
Little Jeannot, he says, looking after the ambassador. He still fears the English summer, and the king. When he had his first audience with Henry, he could not stop shaking from terror. We had to hold him up, Norfolk and myself.
Did I misunderstand?
The constable says.
Or did he say Weston was guilty of poems?
Something like that. Anne, it appears, was a book left open on a desk for anyone to write on the pages, but only her husband should inscribe.
Anyway, there's a matter off my mind,
the constable says.
Did you ever see a woman burned? It is something I wish never to see, as I trust in God.
When Cranmer comes to see him on the evening of the 16th of May, the Archbishop looks ill, shadowed grooves running from nose to chin. Were they there a month ago?
I want all this to be over, he says, and to get back to Kent.
Did you leave Greta there? He says gently.
Cranmer nods. He seems hardly able to say his wife's name. He is terrified every time the king mentions marriage, and of course these days the king mentions little else.
She is afraid that, with his next queen, the king will revert to Rome, and we shall be forced to part. I tell her no, I know the king's resolve, but whether he will change his thinking so that a priest can live openly with his wife. If I thought there was no hope of that, then I think I should have to let her go home, before there is nothing there for her. You know how it is. In a few years people die, they forget you. You forget your own language, or so I suppose.
There is every hope, he says firmly. And tell her, within a few months, in the new Parliament, I shall have wiped out all remnants of Rome from the statute books. And then, you know, he smiles, once the assets are given out. Well, once they have been directed to the pockets of Englishmen, they will not revert to the pockets of the Pope. He says, how did you find the Queen? Did she make her confession to you?
No, it is not yet the time. She will confess, at the last, if it comes to it.
He is glad, for Cranmer's sake. What would be worse at this point? To hear a guilty woman admit everything, or to hear an innocent woman beg, and to be bound to silence either way? Perhaps Anne will wait until there is no hope of a reprieve, preserving her secrets till then. He understands this. He would do the same.
I told her the arrangements made,
Cranmer says,
for the annulment hearing. I told her it will be at Lambeth, it will be tomorrow. She said, will the king be there? I said, no, madam, he sends his proctors. She said, he is busy with Seymour, and then she reproached herself, saying, I should not speak against Henry, should I? I said it would be unwise. She said to me, may I come there to Lambeth to speak for myself? I said, no, there is no need. Proctors have been appointed for you, too. She seemed downcast. But then she said, tell me what the king wants me to sign. Whatever the king wants, I will agree. He may allow me to go to France to a convent. Does he want me to say I was wed to Harry Percy? I said to her, Madam, the Earl denies it. And she laughed.
He looks doubtful. Even the fullest disclosure, even a complete and detailed admission of guilt, it would not help her. Not now, though it might have helped before the trial. The king doesn't want to think about her lovers, past or present. He has wiped them out of his mind, and her too. She would not credit the extent to which Henry has erased her. He said yesterday,
I hope these arms of mine will soon receive Jane.
Cranmer says,
She cannot imagine that the king has abandoned her. It is not yet a month since he made the emperor's ambassador bow to her.
I think he did that for his own sake, not for hers.
I don't know, Cranmer says. I thought he loved her. I thought there was no estrangement between them up until the last. I am forced to think I don't know anything, not about men, not about women, not about my faith nor the faith of others. She said to me, Shall I go to heaven because I have done many good deeds in my time?
She has made the same inquiry of Kingston. Perhaps she is asking everybody.
She talks of works.
Cranmer shakes his head.
She says nothing of faith. And I hoped she understood, as I now understand, that we are saved not by our works, but only through Christ's sacrifice and through his merits, not our own.
Well, I do not think you should conclude that she was a papist all this time. What would it have availed her?
I am sorry for you, Cranmer says, that you should have the responsibility of uncovering it all.
I did not know what I would find when I began. That is the only reason I could do it, because I was surprised at every turn. He thinks of Mark's boasting, of the gentlemen before the court twitching away from each other and evading each other's eyes. He has learned things about human nature that even he never knew. Gardner in France is clamoring to know the details. But I find I do not want to write the particulars. They are so abominable.
Draw a veil over it,
Cranmer agrees. Though the king himself, he does not shrink from the details, it seems. Cranmer says,
He is taking it around with him, the book he has written. He showed it the other evening at the Bishop of Carlisle's house. You know Francis Bryan has the lease there. In the midst of Brian's entertainments, the king took out this text and began to read it aloud and press it on all the party. Grief has unhinged him.
No doubt, he says. Anyway, Gardner will be content. I have told him he will be the gainer when the spoils are given out. The offices, I mean, and the pensions and payments that now revert to the king. But Cranmer is not listening.
She said to me, When I die... Shall I not be the king's wife? I said, No, madam, for the king would have the marriage annulled, and I have come to seek your consent to that. She said, I consent. She said to me, But will I still be the queen? And I think under statute she will be. I did not know what to say to her, but she looked satisfied. But it seemed so long, the time I was with her. One moment she was laughing, and then praying, and then fretting. She asked me about Lady Worcester, the child she is carrying. She said she thought the child was not stirring as it should, the lady being now in her 5th month or so, and she thinks it is because Lady Worcester has taken fright or is sorrowing for her. I did not like to tell her that this lady had given a deposition against her.
I will inquire, he says, about my lady's health, though not of the Earl. He glared at me, I do not know for what cause. A number of expressions, all of them unfathomable, chase themselves across the Archbishop's face.
Do you not know why? Then I see the rumour is not true. I am glad of it.
He hesitates.
You really do not know? The word at court is that Lady Worcester's child is yours.
He is dumbfounded.
Mine? They say you have spent hours with her behind closed doors.
And that is proof of adultery? Well, I see that it would be. I am paid out. Lord Worcester will run me through.
You do not look afraid.
I am afraid, but not of Lord Worcester. More of the times that are coming, and climbing the marble steps to heaven, her good deeds like jewels weighting wrists and neck. Cranmer says,
I do not know why, but she thinks there is still hope.
All these days he is not alone. His allies are watching him. Fitzwilliam is at his side, disturbed still by what Norris half told him and then took back. Always talking about it, taxing his brain, trying to make complete sentences from broken phrases. Nicholas Carew is mostly with Jane, but Edward Seymour flits between his sister and the Privy Chamber, where the atmosphere is subdued, vigilant, and the king, like the Minotaur, breathes unseen in a labyrinth of rooms. He understands his new friends are protecting their investment. They watch him for any sign of wavering. They want him as deep in the matter as they can contrive, and their own hands hidden, so that if later the king expresses any regret or questions the haste with which things were done, it is Thomas Cromwell and not they who will suffer. Rich and Master Risley keep turning up too. They say, we want to give attendance on you, we want to learn, we want to see what you do. But they can't see. When he was a boy, fleeing to put the narrow sea between himself and his father, he rolled penniless into Dover and set himself up in the street with the three-card trick. See the Queen? Look well at her. Now, where is she? The Queen was in his sleeve. The money was in his pocket. The gamblers were crying, You will be whipped! He takes the warrants to Henry to be signed. Kingston has still received no word of how the men are to die. He promises, I will make the King concentrate his mind. He says, Majesty, there is no gallows at Tower Hill, and I do not think it would be a good idea to take them to Tyburn. The crowds might be unruly.
Why would they? Henry says. The people of London do not love these men. Indeed, they do not know them.
No, but any excuse for disorder. And if the weather stays fine. The king grunts. Very well. The headsman. Mark too? After some sort. I promised him mercy if he confessed, and you know he did confess freely. The king says,
Has the Frenchman come?
Yes, Jean de Dinteville. He has made representations.
No,
Henry says. Not that Frenchman. He means the Calais executioner. He says to the king, Do you think that it was in France, when the queen was at court there in her youth? Do you think it was there she was first compromised? Henry is silent. He thinks, then speaks.
She was always pressing me, do you mark what I say? Always pressing on me the advantage of France. I think you are right. I have been thinking about it, and I do not believe it was Harry Percy took her maidenhead. He would not lie, would he? Not on his honour as a peer of England? No. I believe it was in the court of France she was first debauched.
So he cannot tell if the Calais headsman, so expert in his art, is a mercy at all, or if this form of death dealt to the Queen simply meets Henry's severe sense of the fitness of things. But he thinks, if Henry blames some Frenchman for ruining her, some foreigner unknown and perhaps dead, so much the better. So it was not Wyatt, he says.
No,
Henry says somberly.
It was not Wyatt.
He had better stay where he is, he thinks, for now. Safer, so. But a message can go to him to say he is not to be tried. He says, Majesty, the Queen complains of her attendance. She would like to have women from her own privy chamber.
Her household is broken up. Fitzwilliam has seen to it.
I doubt the ladies have all gone home. They are hovering, he knows, in the houses of their friends, in expectation of a new mistress. Henry says,
Lady Kingston must stay, but you can change the rest, if she can find any willing to serve her.
It is possible Anne still does not know how she has been abandoned. If Cranmer is right, she imagines her former friends are lamenting her, but really they are in a sweat of fear until her head is off. Someone will do her the charity, he says. Henry now looks down at the papers before him, as if he does not know what they are. The death sentences. To endorse, he reminds him. He stands by the king, while he dips his pen and sets his signature to each of the warrants. Square, complex letters lying heavy on the paper. A man's hand, when all is said. He is at Lambeth, in the court convened to hear the divorce proceedings when Anne's lovers die. This is the last day of the proceedings. It must be. His nephew Richard is there to represent him on Tower Hill and bring him the word of how it was accomplished. Rochford made an eloquent speech, appearing in command of himself. He was killed first and needed 3 blows of the axe, after which the others said not much. All proclaimed themselves sinners. All said they deserved to die, but once again they did not say for what. Mark, left till last and slipping in the blood, called for God's mercy in the prayers of the people. The executioner must have steadied himself, since after his first blunder all died cleanly. On paper it is done. The records of the trials are his, to carry to the Rolls House, to keep or destroy or mislay. But the bodies of the dead men are a dirty, urgent problem. The corpses must be put in a cart and brought within the tower walls. He can see them, a heap of entangled bodies without heads, heaped promiscuously as if on a bed, or as if, like corpses in war, they have already been buried and dug up. Within the fortress they are stripped of their clothes, which are the perquisite of the headsman and his assistants, and left in their shirts. There is a graveyard huddled to the walls of St. Peter ad Vincula, and the commoners will be buried there, with Rochford to go alone beneath the floor of the chapel. But now the dead are without the badges of their ranks, there is some confusion. One of the burial party said, "Fetch the Queen, she knows their body parts." But others, Richard says, cried shame on him. He says jailers see too much. They soon lose their sense of what is fitting. "I saw Wyatt looking down from a grate in the bell tower," Richard says. "He signed to me, and I wanted to give him hope, but I did not know how to signal that." "He will be released," he says, "but perhaps not until Anne is dead." The hours to that event seem long. Richard hugs him, says, "If she had reigned longer, she would have given us to the dogs to eat." "If we had let her reign longer, we would have deserved it." At Lambeth, the 2 proctors for the Queen had been present, as the King's substitutes, Dr. Bedell and Dr. Tregonwell, and Richard Sampson as his counsel, and himself, Thomas Cromwell, and the Lord Chancellor and other counsellors, including the Duke of Suffolk, whose own marital affairs have been so entangled that he has learned a certain amount of canon law, swallowing it like a child taking medicine. Today Brandon had sat making faces and shifting in his chair while the priests and lawyers sifted the circumstances. They had talked over Harry Percy, and agreed he was no use to them.
"I cannot think why you did not get his cooperation, Cromwell," the Duke says.
Reluctantly they had talked over Mary Boleyn, and agreed she would have to furnish the impediment, though the King was as culpable as anyone, for he knew, surely, he could not be contracted to Anne if he had slept with her sister. "I suppose the point was not entirely obvious," Cranmer says, gently. "There was affinity, that is clear, but he had a dispensation from the Pope which he thought held good at the time. He did not know that in so grave a matter the Pope cannot dispense. That point was settled later." It is all most unsatisfactory. The Duke says suddenly,
"Well, you all know she is a witch, and if she witched him into marriage—"
"I don't think the King means that," he says, he, Cromwell.
"Oh, he does," says the Duke. "I thought that was what we had come here to discuss. If she witched him into marriage, it was null, is my understanding."
The Duke sits back, his arms folded. The proctors look at each other. Samson looks at Cranmer. No one looks at the Duke. Eventually Cranmer says,
"We don't have to make it public. We can issue the decree but keep the grounds secret."
A release of breath. He says, "I suppose it is some consolation that we need not be laughed at in public." The Lord Chancellor says,
"The truth is so rare and precious that sometimes it must be kept under lock and key."
The Duke of Suffolk speeds to his barge, crying out that at last he is free of the Boleyns. The end of the King's first marriage was protracted, public and discussed throughout Europe, not only in the councils of princes but in the market square. The end of his second, if decency prevailed, would be swift, private, unspoken and obscure. Yet it is necessary to have it witnessed by the city and by men of rank. The tower is a town. It is an armory, a palace, a mint. Workmen of all sorts, officials come and go. But it can be policed and foreigners evacuated. He sets Kingston to do this. Anne, he is sorry to learn, has mistaken the day of her death, rising at 2 a.m. to pray on the morning of the 18th of May, sending for her almoner and for Cranmer to come to her at dawn so she can purge herself of her sins. No one seems to have told her that Kingston comes without fail at dawn on the morning of an execution to warn the dying person to be ready. She is not familiar with the protocol, and why would she be? Kingston says, "See it from my point of view, 5 deaths in one day and to be ready for a Queen of England the next? How can she die when the appropriate officials from the city are not here? The carpenters are still making her scaffold on Tower Green, though thankfully she cannot hear the knocking from the royal lodging. Still, the constable is sorry for her misapprehension, especially since her mistake ran on late into the morning. The situation is a great strain on both himself and his wife. Instead of being glad of another dawn, he reports, Anne had cried, and said she was sorry not to die that day. She wished she were past her pain. She knew about the French executioner, and,
I told her, Kingston says, it shall be no pain. It is so subtle.
But once again, Kingston says, she closed her fingers around her throat. She had taken the Eucharist, declaring on the body of God her innocence. Which, surely, she would not do, Kingston says, if she were guilty. She laments the men who are gone. She makes jokes, saying that she will be known hereafter as Anne the Headless, Anne sans tête. He says to his son, if you come with me to witness this, it will be almost the hardest thing you ever do. If you can go through it with a steady countenance, it will be remarked on, and it will be much in your favour. Gregory just looks at him. He says,
a woman. I cannot.
I will be beside you to show that you can. You need not look. When the soul passes, we kneel, and we drop our eyes and pray. The scaffold has been set up in an open place where once they used to hold tournaments. A guard of 200 yeomen is assembling, drawing up to lead the procession. Yesterday's bungling, the confusion over the date, the delays, the misinformation, none of that must be repeated. He is there early, when they are putting the sawdust down, leaving his son back in Kingston's lodgings, with the others who are collecting, the sheriffs, aldermen, London's officers and dignitaries. He stands himself on the steps of the scaffold, testing them to see if they take his weight. One of the sawdust men says to him, it's sound, sir, we have all run up and down, but I suppose you want to check it yourself. When he looks up, the executioner is already there, talking to Christoph. The young man is well-dressed, an allowance having been made him for a gentleman's apparel, so that he will not be easy to pick out from the other officials. This is done to save alarm to the Queen, and if the clothes are spoiled, at least he is not out of pocket himself. He walks up to the executioner. How will you do this?
I shall surprise her, sir.
Switching into English, the young man indicates his feet. He is wearing soft shoes, such as one might wear indoors.
She never sees the sword. I have put it there, in the straw. I shall distract her. She will not see from where I come.
But you will show me. The man shrugs.
If you like. Are you Cranmer? They told me you are in charge of everything. In fact, they joke to me, saying, if you faint because she is so ugly, there is one who will pick up the sword. His name is Cranmer, and he is such a man he can chop the head off the hydra, which I do not understand what it is. But they say it is a lizard or serpent, and for each head that is chopped, 2 more will grow.
Not in this case, he says. Once the Boleyns are done, they are done. The weapon is heavy, needing a 2-handed grip. It is almost 4 feet in length, 2 inches broad, round at the tip, a double edge.
One practices like this, the man says.
He whirls like a dancer on the spot, his arms held high, his fists together as if he were gripping the sword.
Every day one must handle the weapon, if only to go through the motions. One may be called at any time. We do not kill so many in Calais, but one goes to other towns. It is a good trade,
Christoph says. He wants to handle the sword, but he, Cromwell, does not want to let go of it yet. The man says,
They tell me I may speak French to her and she will understand me.
Yes, do so.
But she will kneel. She must be informed of this. There is no block, as you see. She must kneel upright and not move. If she is steady, it will be done in a moment. If not, she will be cut to pieces.
He hands back the weapon. I can answer for her. The man says,
Between one beat of the heart and the next, it is done. She knows nothing. She is in eternity.
They walk away. Christoph says,
Master, he has said to me, Tell the woman that she should wrap her skirts about her feet when she kneels, in case she falls bad, and shows off to the world what so many fine gentlemen have already seen.
He does not reprove the boy for his coarseness. He is crude, but correct. And when the moment comes, it will prove the women do it anyway. They must have discussed it among themselves. Francis Bryan has appeared beside him, steaming inside a leather jerkin.
Well, Francis?
I am charged that as soon as her head is off, I ride with the news to the king and Mistress Jane.
Why? He says coldly.
Do they think the headsman might in some way fail?
It is almost 9 o'clock.
Did you eat any breakfast? Francis says.
I always eat my breakfast.
But he wonders if the king did.
Henry has hardly spoken of her, Francis Bryan says, only to say he cannot see how the whole thing occurred. When he looks back on the last 10 years, he cannot understand himself.
They are silent. Francis says, Look, they're coming. The solemn procession through Cold Harbour Gate, the city first, aldermen and officials, then the guard. In the midst of them, the queen with her women. She wears a gown of dark damask and a short cape of ermine, a gable hood. It is the occasion, one supposes, to hide the face as much as possible, to guard the expression. That ermine cape, does he not know it? It was wrapped around Catherine, he thinks, when I saw it last. These furs, then, are Anne's final spoils. 3 years ago, when she went to be crowned, she walked on a blue cloth that stretched the length of the abbey, so heavy with child that the onlookers held their breath for her, and now she must make shift over the rough ground, picking her way in her little lady's shoes, with her body hollow and light, and just as many hands around her, ready to retrieve her from any stumble and deliver her safely to death. Once or twice the queen falters, and the whole procession must slow, but she has not stumbled. She is turning and looking behind her. Cranmer had said,
I do not know why, but she thinks there is still hope.
The ladies have veiled themselves, even Lady Kingston. They do not want their future lives to be associated with this morning's work. They do not want their husbands or their suitors to look at them and think of death. Gregory has slipped into place beside him. His son is trembling and he can feel it. He puts out a gloved hand and rests it on his arm. The Duke of Richmond acknowledges him. He stands in prominent view with his father-in-law, Norfolk. Surrey, the Duke's son, is whispering to his father, but Norfolk gazes straight ahead. How has the House of Howard come to this? When the women strip the Queen of her cape, she is a tiny figure, a bundle of bones. She does not look like a powerful enemy of England, but looks can deceive. If she could have brought Catherine to this same place, she would have. If her sway had continued, the child Mary might have stood here, and he himself, of course, pulling off his coat and waiting for the coarse English axe. He says to his son,
It will be but a moment now.
Anne has given alms out as she walks, and the velvet bag is empty now. She slips her hand inside it and turns it inside out, a prudent housewife's gesture, checking to see that nothing is thrown away. One of the women stretches out a hand for the purse. Anne passes it without looking at her, then moves to the edge of the scaffold. She hesitates, looks over the heads of the crowd, then begins to speak. The crowd as one sways forward, but can only shuffle by inches towards her, every man with his head lifted, staring. The Queen's voice is very low, her words barely heard, her sentiments the usual ones on the occasion.
Pray for the king, for he is a good, gentle,
amiable and virtuous prince.
One must say these things, as even now the king's messenger might come. She pauses. But no, she has finished. There is nothing more to say, and not more than a few moments left of this world. She takes in a breath. Her face expresses bewilderment.
Amen,
she says.
Amen.
Her head goes down. Then she seems to draw herself together to control the tremor that has seized her entire body from head to foot. One of the veiled women moves to her side and speaks to her. Anne's arm shakes as she raises it to lift off her hood. It comes easily, no fumbling. He thinks it cannot have been pinned. Her hair is gathered in a silk net at the nape of her neck, and she shakes it out, gathers up the strands, raising her hands above her head, coiling it. She holds it with one hand, and one of the women gives her a linen cap. She pulls it on. You would not think it would hold her hair, but it does. She must have rehearsed with it. But now she looks about as if for direction. She lifts the cap half off her head, puts it back. She does not know what to do. He sees she does not know if she should tie the cap's string beneath her chin, whether it will hold without fastening, or whether she has time to make a knot, and how many heartbeats she has left in the world. The executioner steps out, and he can see he is very close. Anne's eyes focus on him. The Frenchman bobs to his knees to ask pardon. It is a formality, and his knees barely graze the straw. He has motioned Anne to kneel, and as she does so, he steps away, as if he does not want contact even with her clothes. At arm's length, he holds out a folded cloth to one of the women and raises a hand to his eyes to show her what he means. He hopes it is Lady Kingston who takes the blindfold. Whoever it is, she is adept, but a small sound comes from Anne as her world darkens. Her lips move in prayer. The Frenchman waves the women back. They retreat. They kneel. One of them almost sinks to the ground and is propped up by the others. Despite the veils, one can see their hands, their helpless, bare hands, as they draw their own skirts about them, as if they were making themselves small, making themselves safe. The Queen is alone now, as alone as she has ever been in her life. She says, "Christ, have mercy. Jesus, have mercy. Christ, receive my soul." She raises one arm. Again her fingers go to the coif, and he thinks, "Put your arm down. For God's sake, put your arm down." And he could not will it more if... The executioner calls out sharply, "Get me the sword!" The blinded head whips around. The man is behind Anne. She is misdirected. She does not sense him. There is a groan, one single sound from the whole crowd. Then a silence. And into that silence, a sharp sigh, or a sound like a whistle through a keyhole. The body exsanguinates, and its flat little presence becomes a puddle of gore. The Duke of Suffolk is still standing, Richmond too. All others who have knelt now get to their feet. The executioner has turned away, modestly, and already handed over his sword. His assistant is approaching the corpse, but the four women are there first, blocking him with their bodies. One of them says fiercely, "We do not want men to handle her." He hears young Surrey say, "No, they have handled her enough." He says to Norfolk, "My lord, take your son in charge, and take him away from this place." Richmond, he sees, looks ill, and he sees with approval how Gregory goes to him and bows, friendly as one young boy can be to another, saying, "My lord, leave it now, come away." He does not know why Richmond did not kneel. Perhaps he believes the rumours that the Queen tried to poison him, and will not offer her even that last respect. With Suffolk it is more understandable. Brandon is a hard man, and owes Anne no forgiveness. He has seen battle, though never a bloodletting like this. It seems Kingston did not think further than the death, to the burial. "I hope to God," he Cromwell says to no one in particular, "that the constable has remembered to have the flags taken up in the chapel." And someone answers him, "I think so, sir, for they were levered up 2 days ago so her brother could go under." The constable has not helped his reputation these last few days, though he has been kept in uncertainty by the king, and, as he will admit later, he had thought all morning that a messenger might suddenly arrive from Whitehall to stop it. even when the Queen was helped up the steps, even to the moment she took off her hood. He has not thought of a coffin, but an elm chest for arrows has been hastily emptied and carried to the scene of the carnage. Yesterday it was bound for Ireland with its freight, each shaft ready to deal separate, lonely damage. Now it is an object of public gaze, a death casket wide enough for the Queen's little body. The executioner has crossed the scaffold and lifted the severed head. In a yard of linen he swaddles it like a newborn. He waits for someone to take the burden. The women, unassisted, lift the Queen's sodden remains into the chest. One of them steps forward, receives the head and lays it, no other space, by the Queen's feet. Then they straighten up, each of them awash in her blood, and stiffly walk away, closing their ranks like soldiers. That evening he is at home at Austin Friars. He has written letters into France to Gardiner. Gardiner abroad, a crouching brute nibbling his claws, waiting for his moment to strike. It has been a triumph to keep him away. He wonders how much longer he can do it. He wishes Rafe were here, but either he is with the king or he has gone back to Helen in Stepney. He is used to seeing Rafe most days, and he cannot get used to the new order of things. He keeps expecting to hear his voice, and to hear him and Richard, and Gregory when he is at home, scuffling in corners and trying to push each other downstairs, hiding behind doors to jump on each other, doing all those tricks that even men of 25 or 30 do when they think their grave elders are not nearby. Instead of Rafe, Mr. Risley is with him, pacing. Colney seems to think someone should give an account of the day, as if for a chronicler, or if not that, that he should give an account of his own feelings. "I stand, sir, as if upon a headland, my back to the sea, and below me a burning plain." "Do you, Colney? Then come in from the wind," he says, "and have a cup of this wine Lord Lille sends me from France. I do usually keep it for my own drinking." Colney takes the glass. "I smell burning buildings," he says, "fallen towers. Indeed, there is nothing but ash, wreckage." "But it's useful wreckage, isn't it?" "Wreckage can be fashioned into all sorts of things. Ask any dweller on the seashore." "You have not properly answered on one point," Risley says. "Why did you let Wyatt go untried, other than because he is your friend?" "I see you do not rate friendship highly." He watches Risley take that in. "Even so," Colmy says, "Wyatt, I see, poses you no threat, nor has he slighted or offended you. William Brereton, he was high-handed and offended many. He was in your way. Harry Norris, young Weston, well, there are gaps where they stood, and you can put your own friends in the privy chamber alongside Rafe. And Mark, that squib of a boy with his lute. I grant you the place looks tidier without him. And George Rochford struck down, that sends the rest of the Boleyns scurrying away. Monseigneur will have to scuttle back to the country and sing small. The Emperor will be gratified by all that has passed. It is a pity the ambassador's fever kept him away today. He would like to have seen it." "No, he would not," he thinks. "Chapuis is squeamish. But you ought to get out from your sick bed if you need to, and see the results you have willed." "Now we shall have peace in England," Risley says. A phrase runs through his head. Was it Thomas More's? "The peace of the hen coop when the fox has run home." He sees the scattered carcasses, some killed with one snap of the jaw, the rest bitten and shredded as the fox whirls and snaps in panic, as the hens flap about him, as he spins around and deals death. The remnants then to be sluiced away, the mulch of scarlet feathers plastered over the floor and walls. "All the players gone," Risley says, "all four who carried the cardinal to hell, and also the poor fool Mark, who made a ballad of their exploits." "All four," he says. "All five." "A gentleman asked me, if this is what Cromwell does to the cardinal's lesser enemies, what will he do by and by to the king himself?" He stands looking down into the darkening garden, transfixed, the question like a knife between his shoulder blades. There is only one man among all the king's subjects to whom that question would occur, only one who would dare pose it. There is only one man who would dare question the loyalty he shows to his king, the loyalty he demonstrates daily. "So," he says at last, "Stephen Gardiner calls himself a gentleman." Perhaps, caught in the little panes which distort and cloud, Risley sees a dubious image, confusion, fear, emotions that do not often mark Master Secretary's face. Because if Gardner thinks this, who else? Who else will think it in the months and years ahead? He says, "Risley, surely you don't expect me to justify my actions to you. Once you have chosen a course, you should not apologize for it. God knows, I mean nothing but good to our master, the king. I am bound to obey and serve. And if you watch me closely, you will see me do it." He turns when he thinks it is fit for Risley to see his face. His smile is implacable. He says, "Drink my health." Chapter 3. Spoils. London, summer 1536. The king says,
"What happened to her clothes? Her headdress?"
He says, "The people of the tower have them. It is their perquisite."
"Buy them back,"
the king says.
"I want to know they are destroyed."
The king says,
"Call in all the keys that admit to my privy chamber, here and elsewhere. All the keys to all the rooms. I want the locks changed."
There are new servants everywhere, or old servants in new offices. In place of Henry Norris, Sir Francis Bryan is appointed chief of the Privy Chamber, and is to receive a pension of £100. The young Duke of Richmond is appointed Chamberlain of Chester and North Wales, and, replacing George Boleyn, Warden of the Cinque Ports and Constable of Dover Castle. Thomas Wyatt is released from the Tower and granted £100 also. Edward Seymour is promoted Viscount Beauchamp. Richard Sampson is appointed Bishop of Chichester. The wife of Francis Weston announces her remarriage. He has conferred with the Seymour brothers on the motto Jane should adopt as queen. They settle on bound to obey and serve. They try it out on Henry. A smile, a nod, perfect contentment. The king's blue eyes are serene. Through the autumn of this year, 1536, in glass windows, in carvings of stone or wood, the badge of the phoenix will replace the white falcon with its imperial crown. For the heraldic lions of the dead woman, the panthers of Jane Seymour are substituted, and it is done economically, as the beasts only need new heads and tails. The marriage is swift and private, in the Queen's closet at Whitehall. Jane is found to be the king's distant cousin, but all dispensations are granted in proper form. He, Cromwell, is with the king before the ceremony. Henry is quiet and more melancholy that day than any bridegroom ought to be. He is not thinking about his last queen. She is 10 days dead, and he never speaks of her. But he says,
"Crom, I don't know if I will have any children now. Plato says that a man's best offspring are born when he is between 30 years and 39. I am past that. I have wasted my best years. I don't know where they have gone."
The king feels he has been cheated of his fate.
"When my brother Arthur died, my father's astrologer predicted that I should enjoy a prosperous reign and father many sons."
"You're prosperous, at least," he thinks, "and if you stick with me, richer than you can ever have imagined. Somewhere, Thomas Cromwell was in your chart." The debts of the dead woman now fall to be paid. She owes some £1,000, which her confiscated estate is able to meet, to her farrier and her hosier, her silk women, her apothecary, her linen draper, her saddler, her dyer, her farrier, and her pinmaker. The status of her daughter is uncertain, but for now the child is well provided with gold fringing for her bed and with caps of white and purple satin with gilt trim. The Queen's embroiderer is owed £55, and one can see where the money went. The fee to the French executioner is over £23, but it is an expense unlikely to be repeated. At Austin Friars he takes the keys and lets himself into the little room where they store Christmas, where Mark was held and where he cried out in fear in the night. The peacock wings will have to be destroyed. Rafe's little girl will probably not ask for them again. Children do not remember from one Christmas to the next. When the wings are shaken out of their linen bag, he stretches the fabric, holds it up to the light, and sees that the bag is slit. He understands how the feathers crept out and stroked the dead man's face. He sees that the wings are shabby, as if nibbled, and the glowing eyes dulled. They are tawdry things, after all, not worth setting store by. He thinks about his daughter Grace. He thinks, was my wife ever false to me? When I was away on the cardinal's business, as I so often was, did she take up with some silk merchant she knew through her business, or did she, as many women do, sleep with a priest? He can hardly believe it of her. Yet she was a plain woman, and Grace was so beautiful, her features so fine. They blur in his mind these days. This is what death does to you. It takes and takes, so that all that is left of your memories is a faint tracing of spilled ash. He says to Johanna, his wife's sister, "Do you think Lizzie ever had to do with another man? I mean, while we were married?" Johanna is shocked. "Whatever put that into your head? Put it right out again." He tries to do that, but he cannot escape the feeling that Grace has slipped further from him. She was dead before she could be painted or drawn. She lived and left no trace. Her clothes and her cloth ball and her wooden baby in a smock are long ago passed to other children. But his elder daughter, Anne, he has her copybook. Sometimes he takes it out and looks at it, her name inked in her bold hand. Anne Cromwell. Anne Cromwell, her book. The fish and birds she drew in the margin, mermaids and griffins. He keeps it in a wooden box, faced and lined with red leather. On the lid, the colour has faded to a pale rose. Only when you open it up do you see the original, shocking scarlet. These light nights find him at his desk. Paper is precious. Its offcuts and remnants are not discarded, but turned over, reused. Often he takes up an old letter book and finds the jottings of chancellors long dust, of bishop ministers, now cold under inscriptions of their merits. When he first, in this fashion, turned up Wolsey's hand after his death, a hasty computation, a discarded draft, his heart had clenched small and he had to put down his pen till the spasm of grief passed. He has grown used to these encounters, but tonight, as he flicks over the leaf and sees the cardinal's writing, it is strange to him, as if some trick, perhaps a trick of the light, has altered the letter forms. The hand could be that of a stranger, of a creditor or a debtor you have dealt with just this quarter and don't know well. It could be that of some humble clerk, taking dictation from his master. A moment passes. A soft flicker of the beeswax flame, a nudge of the book towards the light, and the words take on their familiar contours, so he can see the dead hand that inscribed them. During daylight hours he thinks only of the future, but sometimes late at night memory comes to nag him. However, his next task is somehow to reconcile the king and the Lady Mary, to save Henry from killing his own daughter, and before that to stop Mary's friends from killing him. He has helped them to their new world, the world without Anne Boleyn, and now they think they can do without Cromwell too. They have eaten his banquet, and now they will want to sweep him out with the rushes and the bones. But this was his table. He runs on the top of it, among the broken meats. Let them try to pull him down. They will find him armoured. They will find him entrenched. They will find him stuck like a limpet to the future. He has laws to write, measures to take, the good of the Commonwealth to serve, and his king. He has titles and honours still to attain, houses to build, books to read, and, who knows, perhaps children to father, and Gregory to dispose in marriage. It would be some compensation for the children lost to have a grandchild. He imagines standing in a daze of light, holding up a small child so the dead can see it. He thinks, strive as I might, one day I will be gone, and as this world goes it may not be long. What though I am a man of firmness and vigour, fortune is mutable, and either my enemies will do for me, or my friends. When the time comes I may vanish before the ink is dry. I will leave behind me a great mountain of paper, and those who come after me, let us say it is Rafe, let us say it is Risley, let us say it is Rich, they will sift through what remains and remark, here is an old deed, an old draft, an old letter from Thomas Cromwell's time. They will turn the page over and write on me. Summer, 1536. He is promoted Baron Cromwell. He cannot call himself Lord Cromwell of Putney. He might laugh. However, he can call himself Baron Cromwell of Wimbledon. He ranged all over those fields when he was a boy. The word, however, is like an imp coiled beneath your chair. It induces ink to form words you have not yet seen, and lines to march across the page and overshoot the margin. There are no endings. If you think so, you are deceived as to their nature. They are all beginnings. Here is one.
You have been listening to Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel, narrated by Simon Vance. If you have enjoyed this recording and would like to receive information on the latest titles, please contact us at the address on the cover. We will be pleased to send you a catalogue of available titles.